Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service of public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on hospitals when we come back. You know, if you're earning $50,000 a year and you pay all of your 14 taxes, you get to keep 40% of what you create and produce. The government gets the other 60%. That's $20,000 for you, $30,000 for the government. Now, isn't that just special? And if you think that your share isn't enough for you, then why don't you work twice as hard, produce twice as much, and make $100,000 next year? Then go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes just like you did this year, and you're going to net 24%, and the government will net 76%. That means that for working twice as hard and producing twice as much, you net $4,000 more. That's 8%. That's 8% more take-home pay than you did this year by working twice as hard and producing twice as much, guaranteed by Congress and the IRS. That's why I contend that there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to work to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners and then only net 25% of it. Why don't you call today and order my free 4-hour CD package, and let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information, and it'll answer many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is that we pay so much and receive so little. And let me teach you how to do just that in my Tax and Status School, which is now available on compact disc for adult home study. To order your free general law CD package, just call direct 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967, or you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email, send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org. Or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. Mandatory overtime. Hospitals have mandatory overtime. That's the problem that nurses face, because there's a nursing shortage here in the United States. We don't have enough registered nurses to do the job. And so as a result, hospitals press those nurses into working longer hours. Nurses that work longer hours become fatigued and make mistakes, which cost billions of dollars in malpractice suits and wrongful death actions, which is what we've been talking about. Hospitals used to be the safest place in town. Today, it's more dangerous than the streets of Baghdad. Your chances of getting killed in the United States Army in Iraq today are less than being killed by your local family physician in your local neighborhood hospital. You got a better survival rate coming out of Iraq than you do coming out of your local hospital, for crying out loud. Now, the nurses of today are just as important as doctors. Hospitals thrive on their training and skills to care for sick patients. Nurses are the heart and backbone of all hospital facilities. Nurses' duties consist of injecting pharmaceutical drugs into a patient's IV, measuring dosage, monitoring vital signs, keeping detailed logs of intake of medicine and other important procedures that go with the nursing profession. Hospitals all across the world depend on their valuable skills and determination to help people on their road to recovery. Now, there are different types of nurses, all which work in different paced environments. There are those who work in a calm setting where a patient is scheduled for a long stay, and then there are those who work in the emergency room, intensive care units, nursing homes, schools, and many diverse areas. The emergency room is a fast-paced and hardcore working facility. Nurses within that department depend on their high energy and focus to make fast and accurate decisions. It's hard to imagine a hospital with a shortage of nurses, but every day it becomes more perceptible that the United States is going to be faced with a nursing crisis for the years to come. Now, it's been estimated that by the year 2020, hospital facilities will be in need of 800,000 registered nurses. Many hospitals today are currently in need of nurses. Very few of them are appropriately staffed with the adequate number of staff nurses. And although there has been a significant rise in the total number of registered nurses over the past years, there is still plenty of holes to fill. Research done by the Health Resources and Services Administration found that the average age of a registered nurse in America is 44 years old, 44 for the year of 2000. This is why it is so obvious that the shortage will continue to grow, with more middle-aged women retiring and nursing shortages, or the nursing shortages, far from being alleviated anytime soon. 75% of hospital openings in America are vacancies for registered nurses. This clearly shows how desperate the demand for nurses is becoming. In a hospital in Baltimore, patient beds are constantly being shut down and put out of service because of a staff shortage. The vice president of nursing and patient care services in Baltimore said that she is surprised that hospitals can't appeal to enough nurses to staff its procedures because RNs are offered one of the highest salaries in the marketplace. The majority of hospitals spend 20% of their budget on nurses' wages, and it is one of the biggest expenses that the hospitals cover. Even though the pay for nurses keeps on growing, hospitals still cannot manage to keep its units staffed. The shortage is getting so critical that hospitals find themselves competing for nurses by offering the best benefit plans and the highest pay. Some have gone as far as offering house cleaning for new recruits. The recruiting tactics are simply a fight against lack of supply. Hospitals in Boston have taken the initiative upon themselves to aid the shortage by offering mentoring programs for nurses and focusing more on nurse retention programs. This can hopefully maintain nurses with a high morale and keep them from quitting their jobs. For many states, the potential for more nurses in the labor market is clearly apparent, but the main problem is that there aren't enough faculty members to teach and train new nurses in these teaching hospitals. Students are often discouraged by the long waiting list that is needed to enter a nursing program. The New York-based National League for Nursing estimates that the U.S. needs 60,000 nursing teachers to train these new recruits and properly address the shortage of today. The NYNBL also found that more than 125,000 qualified applicants were turned down last year due to faculty and resource shortages in the teaching hospitals. As the shortage increases, more and more nurses are confronted with overtime in order to keep hospitals running efficiently with the RN to patient ratio. Some hospital facilities use what is called mandatory overtime, which is an involuntary unscheduled time of work. These nurses are forced to work past their scheduled hours. If they refuse, they can be charged with patient abandonment, and as a result, they can lose their registered nurse's license. Mandatory overtime endangers the patient's well-being as well as employees and the people surrounding them. It is an unsafe practice which needs to be abolished because an RN's fatigue and exhaustion after a 12-hour shift can prove to be deadly when handling pharmaceutical drugs and delicate machinery. Even the most simple to the most sophisticated industries are known to limit their employees' time, and it seems so ludicrous for the workers of the health system, registered nurses, to have no limitations on their working time. In the delicate field of medicine, there clearly has to be a limitation on nurse overtime. The cost of malpractice suits caused by burned-out nurses has significantly increased over the years, and hospitals end up paying billions of dollars a year for simple and preventable errors. A fatigued and worn-out nurse that is put into an overtime shift is a hazard. Most of the nurses that work overtime make severe errors because of their lack of good judgment. The outcome of mandatory overtime is clearly a dangerous solution to the nursing crisis. Now, many industries all across the world monitor their staff's working conditions and hours to protect the health and safety of the public. The best example of these industries, for instance, is transportation. The pilots and aircraft members aboard a plane have to keep logs of their precise flying time, and they have limitations on hours of flight. Truck drivers are also monitored closely by their detailed logs and logbooks to ensure adequate amounts of sleep. All of these logs are closely guarded by the highway patrol agents and local police. A pilot of a passenger airliner and a registered nurse share the same responsibility, which is to protect and serve its patrons. It doesn't make sense that nurses are forced to work overtime considering the dangers. So what if there was a pilot shortage? Would they then make the remaining pilots fly another long route after completing their first one? Would they enforce mandatory overtime? I don't think so. With so much responsibility on hand, it would be foolish to let them fly over their mandated time, with the medical field being so sensitive and delicate. There clearly needs to be limitations. Mandatory overtime is just a clueless tool that works in emergency situations but has a negative impact on the nursing crisis. Because many nurses are driven away or discouraged by such requirements to work overtime, these nurses leave their field of work in search of more flexibility with their schedules and more stability with their working hours. A member from the American Nurse Association said that mandatory overtime attributes to the shortage because it puts pressure on staff and imposes a lot of stress on fellow employees, and as a result, they leave their jobs for less demanding jobs. There's no doubt that the increasing amount of overtime threatens a nurse's ability to provide safe and individualized care for patients. After working a 12-hour shift, nurses are more liable to make simple errors. Research made by Dawson and Reed concluded that prolonged periods of wakefulness in excess of 16 hours can reduce performance equivalent to a blood alcohol concentration of 0.05. This clearly shows how much a nurse's ability to do her job lessens substantially with long overtime shifts. Dr. James Cunningham, a 30-year-old cardiovascular surgeon and physician, said, "With long hours and a high-stress job combined with family and other responsibilities, nurses can quickly burn out." Ann Rogers, an associate professor of nursing, concluded in her sample of 393 registered nurses that the nurses working overtime were more susceptible to erroneous behavior. Jim Devine, a Scottish health organizer, said, "It is a problem of exhaustion. If someone worked a 12-hour shift, would you want them to then dispense medicines? No matter how dedicated a nurse is, the human body just tends to wear out after a long work period." Now, in many hospital institutes, nurses tend to quickly burn out with their heavy workloads. Mandatory overtime often leads to costly consequences for healthcare organizations. According to Circadian Technologies, a consulting firm specializing in human fatigue and other work-related impairments, they found an increase in malpractice lawsuits against nurses. Recent studies by the Institute of Medicine found that medical errors made by medical staff cause between 44 and 98,000 fatalities per year. This is certainly a high number of deaths that can be prevented by eradicating mandatory overtime. This clearly shows a correlation between long working hours and patient endangerment. So why not abolish mandatory overtime and enforce another plan to aid the nursing shortage? The nurse shortage has proved to be a fight against lack of supply. Mandatory overtime is one of the weapons used to fight the shortage. Mandatory overtime and the nurse shortage are dependent on each other. It's an issue of balance. For example, if the shortage for nurses decreases, the use of mandatory overtime decreases. A support group of public health called the American Hospital Association said that mandatory overtime is a safety valve that hospitals use as a last resort to meet unexpected jumps in patient volume. It is evident that the consequences of not having mandatory overtime nurses would be worse or could be worse for patients, but I still feel there are other options other than mandatory overtime. Health advocates need to be creative and think of more sophisticated and elaborate ideas so we can at least lessen the use of mandatory overtime. So in conclusion, nurses cannot be pushed beyond their limits. They're not machines that can be pushed beyond their stamina. And clearly, they are more vulnerable to medical errors if overworked. There undoubtedly needs to be new ideas, better tools to fight the shortage, and mandatory overtime should be a tool of little or no use. There are other options out there that are less risky and potentially less expensive in the long run. Hopefully, new ideas will be brought forward that prove to be less harmful for patients and registered nurses. Eliminating mandatory overtime will be a big step toward the improvement of the nursing crisis. Well, there's that story. Now let's go back here to the teaching hospital. There's short 60,000 instructors in the nursing hospitals to teach new nurses. Recently, there's been a large influx of nurses coming into the United States from overseas. They're not outsourcing your job. They're bringing in nurses from the Philippines that work for $15 an hour instead of $60 an hour, which is what nurses get here. But why is there a nursing teachers shortage? It's because if you're a registered nurse working in a hospital, you get $60 an hour. If you're a professor working in a teaching hospital, you're getting about $30 an hour. So more and more teachers, that is nursing teachers, are saying to hell with this, and they either go to work in the hospital where they can make twice as much money, or they retire or go into something else that pays them more money. Now my common sense tells me that a teacher in a nursing hospital ought to be getting paid as much as or more than the student is getting paid working in a hospital. Let me tell you a little story. Oftentimes there are institutions that are operated by people with college degrees that don't have very much in the way of common sense or practical business experience. Now, I'm an old-timey businessman, and when I was a young man coming up through the ropes, the old-timers, I didn't go to college, I didn't get an MBA, I didn't listen to some professor expounding and explaining the theories of money-making and profitability. Instead, I learned the practical application of how do you get more for less? How do you increase profits and cut costs, or how do you cut costs and increase profits? Farmers have been doing that for 100 years, and they're probably the best people in the country for doing that. You have fewer farmers producing more tonnage than ever before in history. The American farmer, just one guy working by himself, produces more tonnage than anybody else in the world. He isn't the best farmer, and there's a lot of problems with our agriculture, but you got to hand it to the innovation that comes from the business model of American farming. Well, my brother-in-law was in the Air Force, and the Air Force was having a hard time keeping their qualified pilots because, you see, you come out of college and you go into the Air Force, and you're in the Air Force for 7 years. So you go fly your airplane off of aircraft carriers, and you go fly your C-5As, and you fly all over the world. You become a pretty competent guy. Now, United Airlines would like to hire a good, competent guy that comes out of the Air Force or out of the Navy, and so they offer to pay this guy $100,000 or $150,000 a year to come fly the friendly skies. So you can see that Air Force pilots that are making $15,000 a year aren't very likely to re-enlist and then spend another 7 years in the Air Force working for $15,000 a year when they can leave the Air Force and go make $100,000 or $150,000 flying for the airline. So as a business 101 problem here, what would you do if you were the Air Force general in command? Well, let's take a look at what does it cost to train a new recruit. So I asked my brother-in-law, I said, okay, let's suppose that I join the Air Force in the morning and I want to become a pilot. What does it cost? And he said, well, it costs $100,000. Now, this is back in the 1960s, so I imagine today it's probably 10 times more than that, but it cost at that time $100,000 to train a pilot. So I said, well, Johnny, if you leave the Air Force and you don't re-enlist, it's going to cost the Air Force $100,000 to recruit a new man and train him to fly. Is that what you're telling me? He said, that's exactly correct. I said, well, okay, now, that being the case, if you were to re-enlist, do they have any kind of a bonus system? He said, yeah, they do. I said, well, how much of a bonus are they going to pay you? And he said, $15,000, the equivalent of 1 year's pay. So if you re-enlist, you sign up for another 6 year term, they're going to give you $15,000 divided by six. That's about, you know, $2,500 a year. But you could drop out of the Air Force and go fly the friendly skies and get $100,000. He said, yep, that's right. I said, well, Johnny, it sounds like a pretty simple solution to me. If I were the general in charge, I would say, well, since it's going to cost me $100,000 to train a new pilot, why don't I give the same $100,000 to the pilot who's already here? Then I've got an experienced man, not a new kid with a runny nose. And this guy is going to re-enlist because he's going to get his same $15,000 a year, plus he's going to get a $100,000 bonus. And he said, you know, if they would pay me a $100,000 bonus, he said, hell, I'd probably re-enlist for less than that. But he said, you know, if they would give me that $100,000 that they're going to pay to train my replacement, I wouldn't leave the Air Force. Well, boys and girls, you know, it's just as simple. If you go to the teaching college and you say to the teaching instructor who's making $60,000 a year, let's say, and you say, you know, we need more teaching instructors. And what we're going to do is we're going to pay you more money as an instructor because we think that as a teacher, as an instructor, you're probably smarter than the student that comes out of the school. So we're going to pay you as much as or more than, and we're going to give you an enlistment bonus. I think you could restaff all of your nursing hospitals, and I think you could fill them up to overflowing. But you see, the schools, they've got a problem. They say, well, gee, we'd have to raise the tuition price. Well, excuse me. Wouldn't you pay a higher tuition price to get your registered nurse's license so that you could make $60 an hour? You know, people go into the doctoring profession or they go to college because they want to come out as a professional and it makes them more money. It isn't that the hospitals aren't paying the nurses enough money. It's that they're overworking the nurses and they don't pay enough money at the teaching hospitals. I mean, it sounds fairly simple, you know, to solve the problem. Now, I don't know why the problem is there, and I'm not going to attribute to that. Somebody's got here with some giant conspiracy trying to overthrow the United States of America. But, you know, the same problem that I see out here in the business world, in the Air Force with their recruiting problems and with this nursing shortage over here, you know, the marketplace works beautifully. If you want to see how well the marketplace works, take a look at illegal drugs. Did you know that marijuana is the biggest cash crop in the United States? In fact, it's the biggest cash crop, and it's so big, $37 billion a year, that it produces more revenue than corn, soybeans, wheat, and one other crop. I think it's cotton. The four biggest crops in America produce about $30 billion a year, and marijuana, just marijuana alone, just the marijuana grown in the United States of America, not the stuff that shipped in from Mexico or South America or from the Middle East, just the marijuana produced in the United States by little farmers, just little guys that are out planting a few plants here and there, and then harvesting their product and taking it out in the marketplace and selling it, sell $37 billion a year. That's how well the free marketplace works. In spite of the penalties if you get caught, and in spite of the illegalities, and in spite of the same weather problems that every other farmer faces, in spite of all of the obstacles, we produce more marijuana than we do wheat, corn, soybeans, and cotton in the United States. more dollar volume. Now, isn't that just special? Now, the marketplace, boys and girls, is predicated upon an old law called Thou Shalt Not Steal. It comes from the Ten Commandments. It's a basic law of economics. Very, very basic law of economics. And that is, people want to work, and they want to work because they want to make something. They want property. So when the guy is out here working, growing marijuana, he's not out there because he sees that there's a need out there in the world for marijuana and he wants to fill the need. He sees that there's a lot of money out there to be made and he wants to make the money. And so he takes the risks, greater risks, risks of jail, maybe risks of getting killed, to produce and then market a product that is patently illegal. And that's the marketplace in action. And that marketplace, boys and girls, works everywhere. For instance, in Bosnia, during the 1990s, there was a war going on over there. Do you remember that? In the old Yugoslavia? And here's this little country fractionalizing, and there's this little place over there called Bosnia, and they've got a town over there called Sarajevo, and there's artillery ringing the city, and they're just bombarding this city constantly with artillery rounds. And people are getting killed over there every day, kind of like Baghdad, you know, just people getting killed every day. And you could readily understand that, you know, the average Joe Sixpack couldn't just run down to the 7-Eleven store and fill up his car with gas. And you couldn't just run down to the local Starbucks, you know, and order a latte. But for $4 a cup and $20 a gallon, there was no shortage of coffee or gasoline in Sarajevo. Yes, it was $4 a cup for coffee and $20 a gallon for gas. But as long as there's a marketplace, there will always be somebody who wants to fill the need. So somebody's going to go out there if they have to pack the gasoline in on camels or on donkey backs. They'll bring the gasoline if there's a reward for it. Now, the opposite to that is this concept of communism. And Americans have embraced communism as if they invented it themselves. We practice the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, and then we wonder, why do we have a nursing shortage? Why do we have $4 a gallon gasoline? Well, the reason is because communism destroys the incentive to create and to produce. You have to have incentive. Now, you can call this the black market. And as long as people are willing to pay $20 a gallon for gasoline, and as long as there are people that are willing to risk their lives to fill the supply, there will be gasoline in Sarajevo. There will be gasoline in Baghdad. But the reason that you have long lines in Baghdad for gasoline in a country that has 25% of the oil wealth of the world is because you have the government intervening in the marketplace. If the government stays out of the marketplace, you won't have any problem filling the supply. There is no shortage of cocaine in the United States of America. There is no shortage of marijuana in this country. There is no shortage of heroin in the United States. We've got plenty. The price is right, and there's plenty of supply. The marketplace works. And boys and girls, the marketplace will work in the nursing field. It'll work in the hospitals. But not as long as the government is interfering. And I pointed that out to you the other day, that you've got socialized medicine here in the United States. And the reason that your medical system is disintegrating is because of that socialized medicine. When the hospitals have to serve 88,000 people in Los Angeles County that don't pay for those services, then the hospitals have to raise prices on the customers that do pay, or they have to cut back on expenses and services to those customers in order to balance their books. The reason that there's a farming problem in the United States, the reason that farmers are leaving the land, like nurses are leaving the hospitals, and teaching nurses are leaving the teaching colleges, is because of the government's interference in the marketplace. And anytime the government interferes in the marketplace, you will then have a shortage, and you can stand in line and share the shortage. You can say, yeah, but it costs less. Okay, well, stand in line, share the shortage, and pay less. But for those of us that are willing to pay the price, there will be no shortages. Now, that's the way the marketplace works. Now, these nurses and their working conditions have implications for infectious disease. And I'll come back with more on that when I give you your mid-course reminder that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet daily. And if you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call us at the Law School. The number's 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Working conditions for nurses. You know, the Institute of Medicine's report, To Air Is Human, which spotlighted the problem of patient safety, reported that tens of thousands of Americans die each year as a result of human error in the delivery of health care. Authors of a more recent Institute of Medicine report, Keeping Patients Safe, Transforming the Work Environment of Nurses, concluded that nursing is inseparably linked to patient safety, and emphasizing that poor working conditions for nurses and inadequate nurse staffing levels increase the risk for error. Nurse working conditions are related to patients' risk of healthcare-associated infections and occupational injuries and infections among staff. And we discuss the Nurse Workforce Review Research Examining Nurses as it relates to infectious diseases, identifying gaps in the literature, and discuss potential policy options. Although our focus is on the nursing workforce in the United States, international trends and comparisons are also discussed. Now, nearly 3 million registered nurses work here in the United States. 95% of these nurses are women, as are most of the 700,000 licensed practical nurses and 2 million unlicensed nurse assistants. Internationally, occupation distributions seem to be similar. Now, more than 1 million registered nurses work in hospitals, which makes nursing the largest hospital workforce. In 60% of U.S. hospitals, the vacancy rates for nurses has increased since 1999 by 14%. And 14% of hospitals now report a severe nursing shortage. For instance, in many hospitals, it's up to 20% of the positions are vacant. The American Hospital Association has reported that hospitals have up to 168,000 vacant positions. 126,000, that's 75% of the available positions in these hospitals, are for registered nurses. And the current nursing shortage is related to an aging workforce, problems with retaining licensed personnel, and a difficulty recruiting young people into the nursing workforce. The demand for registered nurses is projected to grow by 22% by 2008, and unless market corrections are made, the nursing shortage may reach 800,000 vacant positions by 2020. And recent reports document that the nursing shortage is a severe and growing global problem. Pause. Why is it a recurring global problem? Well, because most countries have socialized medicine. And where you have socialized medicine, you have a deteriorating workforce, you have a lowering of standards, you have a higher turnover, a shortage of personnel, and you have bad medicine. Now, up in Canada, when you Canadians, you know, need hospital services, you come down here to the United States. And now there's a growing trend here in the United States to leave the United States and go to the Philippines or India to have elective surgeries done. You know, if you're driving down the road and you have an accident and they take you into the ER and you need emergency services, you know, can't very well go to India. But if you're having a hip replacement, or if you're having some kind of a standard procedure done, which in this country, such as but not limited to bypass surgery, which costs $100,000, if you're one of those people who doesn't have insurance, and you're faced with a bypass surgery procedure that's going to cost you $100,000, and you can get that same procedure done in New Delhi for $20,000, which will include your airfare over and your airfare back, why in the world wouldn't you have it done in India, in a for-profit institution by Indian doctors trained in the United States who work in India? And they don't have a nursing shortage in those hospitals, and they don't have a doctor shortage, and they don't have the same kinds or the same problems with malpractice, because they're not killing people in those hospitals. What's the difference? It's marketplace economics. That's the difference. When you get the government out of the business, you'll find that that business just works like a shot. The marketplace, boys and girls, just works beautifully. We don't have a problem with our marketplace. We have a problem with the government interfering in the marketplace, creating monopolies. For instance, let me give you an illustration. 100 years ago, if you owned a piece of land like I do here, and you suspected that there might be oil underneath it, you could drill. You could go buy a drilling rig. You could contract with some private wildcatter to come in and drill a hole in the ground. And if you found oil, you could take that oil to any one of hundreds of private refineries all over America and sell that oil and make money. That was the marketplace at work. There was never any shortage. The price of oil was about $2.75 a barrel. $2.75 a barrel. And it stayed that way until the 1970s. Well, then the big oil companies, you know, like Standard Oil, the Rockefeller monopoly and so on, they took a look and they said, look, half the oil in this country is produced by the big oil companies like Shell and Conoco and Standard Oil, and half of it's produced by these little guys. And the big oil companies got together and they said, what can we do to increase profits? Well, one of the things they figured they could do is to eliminate the competition. Because as long as there are thousands and thousands of little independent oil well producers out here producing oil for the marketplace, it's damn hard for us to come into the marketplace and jack the price up. Well, how are we going to do that? We can't go to Congress and have them outlaw little independent guys. And so they came up with a neat plan. So they, here's what they did. They went out to the environmental groups. In fact, they're the backbone of the environmental movement. ARCO, Atlantic Richfield, is the biggest single contributor to one of the big greeny outfits. I forget which one it is now, but Sierra Club, I think it is, but one of the big greeny outfits. Now, why would an oil company want to be, you know, supporting this greeny outfit that's over here lambasting the oil industry? Well, it makes all the sense in the world. Listen to this. And they went to the Congress, that's these environmental groups, and they said, look, these oil companies, they're just really bad guys. They go out here and they besmirch and they pollute the environment. And they showed a number of examples of people that went out and polluted and besmirched the environment. Real honest-to-God cases, no doubt about it. And so the greenies, they went into the Congress and they said, well, we got to have an environmental law passed. We got to limit this. And so they did. The Congress, you know, expressing the will of the majority of people out here, and all of you people got on the bandwagon and you said, well, we got to stop all of this besmirching of our environment. And so you passed these environmental laws. And so the net effect of the environmental laws was the little oil operators had to close down because they could not meet the new environmental standards. This meant then that the only people who could meet the environmental standards were the big oil companies who had all of the big bucks. So, as an illustration, 17% of the oil produced in the United States in 1970 came from what was known as stripper wells. That's some little guy that's got 9 or 10 little wells over here, and once a week he goes over and he collects the oil off of them and takes it in and some. 17%. All the stripper wells in America shut down. 17% of the oil production in the United States was destroyed by the big multinational corporations. Not that that was the solution to the oil problem, but 17% here and 5% there and 2% somewhere else. Well, pretty soon that adds up to half the oil produced in the country. So over time, we eliminated 50% of the oil production here in the continental United States. Doesn't mean we don't produce oil here, but we would be producing twice as much oil today if we still had the same little guys out here working, drilling wells, running the little stripper operations, and had a free marketplace. But when the government got into the environmental business and they got into the oil business and the regulation of oil, they went out and they said, okay, you've got to have a certain blend of gasoline. Well, little refineries could not meet those blending requirements. I had a student come in here one time. He was a little guy down in Hobbs, New Mexico, and he was blending his own gas. He had 6 little convenience stores, and he could blend his own gas. He could buy the components, blend his own gas, sell it in his own gas stations for 10 or 15 cents a gallon less than the majors. Oh, no. You see, Standard Oil, they don't want that. They don't want that kind of competition from little guys. And so by having these blending requirements, requiring that the gasoline contain so much hydrogen and so much of this chemical and that additive and that octane and so on, it isn't the guy's customers that are complaining. It's the Environmental Protection Agency. It's Standard Oil that's complaining. And so they eliminated 50%. All the little guys in America are gone. The only people that produce oil or refine oil in America are the big multinational corporations. Welcome to the $4 gallon of gas. And boys and girls, get used to the $6 gallon of gas, because that's where it's going. That's what monopoly is all about. We're not talking about free marketplaces here. We're talking about monopoly. And John D. Rockefeller, who was the founder of Standard Oil, said, you know, competition is a sin. And so the big corporations, they go to work and they go to Congress and they work with the Congress, and Congress works with the oil industry. Congress works with big pharmaceuticals. The Congress works with the big farming institutions like Archer Daniels, Midlands, and Cargill. They're not working for little farmers. They're not working for little gas station guys or for little independent producers. They're not working for small business. They're working for big business. That's the way that game is played. And boys and girls, medicine is big business. Now, there's no better way to raise prices than to produce a shortage. I mean, that's the heart and core of making profit. It's to create a shortage. If there's plenty of gasoline out there, there can't be $4 a gallon gas if there's plenty of supply. But when we can limit supply, there hasn't been a refinery built in the United States for 30 years. We haven't built any refineries. Who in the hell builds refineries? Standard Oil. Why would Standard Oil want to build a refinery and produce more gasoline and eliminate the shortage, which then would eliminate the higher price, which then eliminates the higher profits? Let's be intelligent people. The big oil companies are not going to build refineries in the United States. They're going to limp along with the refineries that they've got. And then in addition to that, the big oil companies can then come to the Congress and say, geez, you know, you've already got a shortage, and if you want us to upgrade this refinery and stop polluting the air, we'll do that, but we got to shut it down. It's going to cost a lot of money and a lot of production. And so the Congress says, well, give them a waiver, give them a free ride, because we don't want them to shut that down. Now, the Congress, the legislatures, and big business, they work like hand inside of a glove. They go together like a pair. The same thing is true here with the nurses shortage. By creating a nurses shortage, by creating a shortage in the marketplace, we can justify raising rates and raising profits. So the hospitals come along and say, well, look, we have to take care of these people out here, so we're going to cut back. So we cut back on the cleaning staff. We cut back on the number of nurses. We start putting in nurses assistants at $9 an hour instead of registered nurses. It's a part and parcel with the program. The hospitals working with the legislatures and the Congress have created an artificial shortage. It's a shortage created by government. There wasn't any nursing shortage in 1950. Whatever it was we were doing in 1950, we should be doing today, and we could eliminate that shortage. There wasn't any gasoline shortage in 1950. Whatever it was we were doing in 1950, we should be doing today. But boys and girls, in 1950, we were still practicing some elements of the Ten Commandments, and we weren't practicing all of the elements yet of the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto, but today we are. You see, the second plank to the Communist Manifesto calls for a heavy progressive income tax. Our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention did not saddle us with a heavy progressive income tax. Our Constitution prescribes the funding of American government to be done by impost and ex post tariffs, not free trade. Free trade does not finance government. But your government and your big business has come in and they've said, well, what we want to do is finance government with an income tax, and we want to go to free trade. Well, okay. But if you're going to have free trade, then you have to compete with the Chinese, and the Chinese pay 50 cents an hour instead of $5.15 an hour. So you're going to have to compete, boys and girls, with the Chinese, and that's why your jobs are being outsourced. Now, there's no shortage in the private marketplace, in the illegal drug trade, where they are selling cocaine on the streets and heroin and marijuana. Boys and girls, there's no shortage of heroin, cocaine, and marijuana. And the people that are producing it are not complaining about the prices. They're not going to Congress asking for price supports. And the illegal aliens that come across the Rio Grande River working for $5.15 an hour, not a single one of them is unemployed. None of them are standing in line with their hands out. None of them are in welfare. And none of them are complaining about it. The people that are complaining about low wages and unemployment are Americans. Boys and girls, things have changed in this country, and the reason they've changed is because we've changed our political and our economic and our social functions in this country. We have adopted the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto, and we have abandoned the Ten Commandments. That's why you have great prices in pharmaceuticals. The pharmaceutical industry is doing wonderful. It's a monopoly. There's about 10 players. And they're protected by the Food and Drug Administration, by the Congress. That's the only place that you can buy drugs. For instance, let me give you an illustration. Did you know in Canada, where you know, Canada is a backward third world country. I don't know if you knew that or not, you Canadians up there, but I want to tell you that you're living in a backward third world country, because here in the United States, we will not import drugs from Canada because you people in Canada can't produce clean, wholesome, good quality drugs. We have to do that here in the United States. And you Canadians up there don't charge enough for your drugs either, because people from Vermont can drive across the border into Canada and buy the same drugs that they're buying in the United States and Canada for half price. So our Congress, when they passed this drug law, this new drug legislation here in the United States, they specifically wrote in a provision that you couldn't get these drugs from outside the United States. You had to buy them in the United States and had to be paid for at retail plus 10. Boys and girls, that's not business. That's monopoly. Now, I don't blame the pharmaceutical companies. My gosh, you know, I run a school and I'd like to have a monopoly, that everybody in America has to buy one of my schools and I'll set the price. You just sign the check and I'll fill in the amount. I'd like a deal like that. The oil companies have it. The pharmaceutical companies have it. The big agricultural companies have it. And then, of course, you and I have to pay for that. That's why I contend that I think that we were better served by the Ten Commandments than by the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto. And I think that this socialized medicine here in the United States is a bad idea. We've already got it. You're not concerned about electing Hillary Clinton and creating socialized medicine in America. Children, wake up. In Los Angeles County, the hospitals have to service the poorest people in the county. That's the street people on the streets. They get free medical services at taxpayer and at customer, that is the marketplace expense. I don't know if that's good policy or bad policy. I'm not here arguing with the policy. It's what Americans want. It's what America's lawmakers want us to have, and that's what they have delivered to us. I just wanted to explain to you, well, okay, well, don't complain about the bad services and the deaths that go on in our hospitals, because it's the natural result of a system that is created called monopoly in place of the free marketplace. It's always been that way. It's been that way for thousands of years. Governments have been interfering in the marketplace for thousands of years to make profits for certain monopolies. It makes great profits for monopolies like the British East India Tea Company. And our founding fathers looked at that and fomented a rebellion, a revolution. They said, we're not going to buy that damn tea. We're not going to support that monopoly. So over time, when the monopoly gets to be so bad, when the price of gasoline gets to be $6 a gallon, and you people are unable to drive your cars, or at least drive them very far because of the price of gas, then you'll demand some changes. It hasn't come yet, and it isn't coming tomorrow. So you might as well get used to the idea that the price of gas, which is $4 a gallon now in many places, is on its way to 5 and then 6. And it isn't global warming, children. It's your government. It isn't the marketplace that's causing you a problem in your hospitals. It's your government interfering in the hospital marketplace. And where the government doesn't interfere in marijuana, there's no shortage of marijuana, and the farmers that grow it aren't complaining, and the customers that buy it love it. The marketplace works for illegal drugs. And if given a chance, the marketplace will work for anything. I'm out of time. Let me remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact discs. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.